Well, it's nice to see everybody here this morning. There's probably about 1 billion people on planet Earth who are celebrating Easter today. And there are a lot of different customs that surround this particular holiday, man-made as it is. Some are going to celebrate in their own unique way at home. Some are going to be celebrating in the mass of tens of thousands of people in a coliseum or a cathedral. What I find really interesting, though, is with 1 billion people celebrating the day of Jesus Christ rising from the grave, how many of those 1 billion people are really changed by it? How many of those 1 billion people are really affected by it? And how many of those 1 billion people really believe deep within their heart, with their whole heart, that that resurrection was real? Some, to be sure, are going to celebrate Easter simply because it's tradition. They're going to celebrate it because it's a story that was passed down from generation to generation. It is a story that brings them back to their heritage, perhaps, culturally, ethnically. And again, how many people really believe that Jesus was raised from the dead? C.S. Lewis once wrote that believers ought to say, "Jesus Christ was raised from the dead," in the same matter-of-fact way that we might say, "I saw a crocus yesterday." Speaking of that particular quote from C.S. Lewis, a writer out of World Magazine said a few years ago, "One year, it will be the last year. Jesus is coming back again. On that day, everyone will see what was true all along, that the supernatural world is as close to you as the person who is right now sitting on the other side of your door. There is perfect continuity between the seen and the unseen worlds. This is evidenced over and over again throughout the Bible as causes in the spiritual world have effects in the material world and vice versa." The resurrection of Jesus Christ was not just an imaginative story. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is not just a tradition. Jesus was raised from the dead. Actually, physically, literally. When he was raised from the dead, it was not just an action that was unseen, where only angels knew about it. It was an action that was proclaimed to the world by an empty tomb. That empty tomb stands as a witness and a testament then to the veracity of the claim of Jesus Christ that he would overcome the evil one, that he would bring life to a world that until Genesis chapter 3 had always seen death. I need to wake up and understand that the unseen world of the Spirit is as real as the seen world around me. That God is as real as every cent in my checking account. That Jesus is as real as the car that I drive every single day. That he should mean more to me than the job that I go to every day. That the presence of God should mean more to me than the presence of my spouse, my children, my parents, every friend I have, or 200 people in an auditorium this morning. He is who he says he is, and he is real. A couple of verses to think about that attest to the fact that the unseen is as real as the seen. In 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 18, the apostle writes, "While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen." Those are the things that we're supposed to be looking at and focusing on. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7, "We walk by faith and not by sight." Hebrews 11 and verse 10, and we'll quote two passages out of Hebrews 11. "He was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." And in verses 26 and 27 of the same chapter, "Considering the reproach of Christ, greater than the treasures of Egypt." This is speaking of Moses. "For he was looking to the reward." And that's not a reward that could be found in the treasure houses in Memphis. He says, "By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen." people like Moses and people like Abraham, people like David, and yes, even Adam himself from the very beginning. Those people made the choices that they did and lived the way that they did in their righteousness because of the unseen God. Because they knew that God was around them, that God was with them, that God was always there, and that what God wanted and expected was a life that was in conformity to them. And of course, the assertion that we need to open up our eyes and start seeing the unseen might sound a little bit esoteric to some people. We live in an evidence-based culture. We always want to know exactly what the calculation is going to be. We want to know exactly what the cost is going to be. We want to know what the evidence is before we move forward with something. So that makes sense. And for a lot of people in Western culture, they don't like to accept the idea that there is an unseen world that has sway and influence and power over that which they can see, that which they can touch, and that which they can measure in a tangible sense. So in this lesson, what I want to do, I want to consider the evidence of the unseen as it works in the seen world. I don't want to go down some esoteric pathway where we hold hands and dim the lights. That's not what I'm talking about here. I want to know, can I see God in the unseen world? More often than not, the argument that unbelievers present to me is, well, if I could just see God, I'd believe in Him. I mentioned last week that Richard Dawkins, great atheist philosopher today, said that I would believe in Jesus if Jesus could just appear in the sky as a 600-foot-tall golden man. Sure, I'd believe in Him if He did that. But then he thought about it and he said, but even then I probably wouldn't believe in Him. People want to see God. People want to see the evidence of God. Prove to me that He's there. Now, we might never be able to present an argument that the die-hard atheist is going to find acceptable. And I understand that. But the reality is there aren't a lot of things that you're going to say to the die-hard atheist that is going to be acceptable in any way. I do believe, though, even with that being said, that we can see God in the world as it is. That His evidence is all around us. We're going to notice Romans chapter 1 here in a few minutes, but I want to kind of give you a teaser here. His invisible attributes, everything that it is to be God, His divine character and His quality, where are they found according to Romans chapter 1? In the seen world. Now even the unbeliever is going to mysticize the creation. They can't help it, by the way. They really can't. They simply cannot help themselves to mysticize the things that they see. You might find somebody who is not a Christian in any sense of the word, and yet when he looks at the world around him, he can't help but be overwhelmed by it. And so we grapple around. We look for God. We try to find God. We try to understand just why it is that this world is so inexplicably beautiful, so inexplicably tragic, so inexplicably awesome. And when you don't include God in the equation, don't be surprised if you can't figure out an answer. Don't be surprised if you find yourself floundering around trying to figure things out. I kind of think about like Eastern mysticism or New Age yoga philosophy. People know that there's something mystical out there. Okay, the New Age person understands that there is a spiritual world. Now, they don't accept the God of the Bible. They certainly don't accept organized religion. But there's a reason why they sit there and play yoga all day long and try to get to the highest levels, the highest initiation, because they believe there's something unseen that's real. They can't see it, but they know it's there. I think the same is true of other religions as well. Hindu, for example. You know that there are almost a billion adherents to Hinduism today. Some estimates are about 950 million. It's the third largest religion in the world. They believe there's something there. Something unseen. The evidence is in the world. The evidence is in the creation and the sustenance and the destruction and the cycle that you see constantly, but it's unseen nevertheless. Even evolution itself. Rebecca and I watched the movie Interstellar last night. Really interesting movie. A feast for the eyes, I'll put it that way. Feast for the eyes kind of movie. Special effects and everything. But at one point, Anne Hathaway's character spent about 5 minutes going on and on and on about how loving human relationships have no evolutionary explanation. That there is no naturalistic reason why people should care about each other. And I think her attitude, at least it's presented in the script of that movie, is typical of even the diehard atheistic evolutionist, even the diehard Darwinian naturalist cannot avoid that some things can't be explained in this world. And I think love is a big part of that. What motivates that? What evolutionary process developed in us the need for these loving human relationships as we express them? And even beyond that, just the thrill that we feel, the creation that surrounds us. Why do we look at a sunset? Why? It means nothing. I mean, you look at a sunset, there's nothing about a sunset that should satisfy us in any way whatsoever. It's simply the rotation of the earth which causes the appearance of the sun to disappear beyond the horizon. It's the color orange. Who cares? Orange, red, pink, doesn't matter. They're colors. It's on the light spectrum. It doesn't matter. There's nothing about a sunset. There's nothing about music. There's nothing about delicious food. There is nothing about any of the things that we find our greatest pleasure in this world that has a naturalistic explanation to it. So even the unbeliever sits here and says, there's something more that I can't see. Something deeper that doesn't have an explanation. And you know what it reminds me of? It does remind me of Acts chapter 17, doesn't it? In Acts chapter 17, as Paul is talking to the philosophers in Athens, they're sitting there stroking their beards, surrounded by the idols of all the gods. And he says here, beginning in verse 22, "Men of Athens, I observe that you're very religious in all respects." I see that in everybody. Everybody's religious. People don't like to admit it. I don't believe in religion. You do. You do. People are bothered when you call them out on it. Everybody's religious. You might have your own religion. You might have made up your own religion. But everybody is religious in some way. You're very religious in all respects. "While I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" To this unknown God. Isn't that what people are looking for? The unseen? The God they can't identify? Now, they don't want it to be the God of the Bible. They don't want it to be the God of Christianity. But they do want something. They are looking for something. He says then, "What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with human hands. Neither is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. And he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation." And look at verse 27. "That they should seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us." Why? Why do we seek God? Why do we seek the unseen? "For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, we are all his offspring. Being then the offspring of God," he says in verse 29, "we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man." He says, if you're looking for God in the seen, you might never find him. You might never find him. That's why every idol and every statue and every image and every icon and every religious service, it's not God. And the earth is not God, by the way. Sorry to the New Age transcendentalists, the earth is not God itself. He says in verse 30, "Having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all everywhere should repent." There's a call then that says, you're looking for God. God is calling out to you. It's up to you if you're going to answer it. So a few things that I notice about the seen world that gives me explanation for the unseen world. First of all, I see God's handiwork in an orderly creation. Psalm 19 and verse 1 says, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, like we already alluded to, said, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes. Again, God is unseen. No avoiding that. Don't try to hide it. Don't pretend like it's not real. God is not physically seen. His invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen. Isn't it funny that which is unseen can be clearly seen by the evidence that we observe around us? Being understood through what has been made. We should be very impressed with the orderly creation that surrounds us. That there's not a lot of haphazard stuff going on planet Earth. Not a lot of accidents. Not a lot of creatures who are accidents or creatures who are falling apart. You know, for a world and an ecosystem and an animal existence, a carbon-based life form, for a world that is supposedly based entirely on chance and natural selection and genetic transformation, it sure seems like everybody is kind of doing what they're supposed to be doing on planet Earth. Right? You know, for everything that's supposed to be based on mutation and how there are good mutations and bad mutations and beneficial mutations and destructive, for a world that is supposedly based on mutations and chance, sure seems like every creature on planet Earth is kind of like doing what it's supposed to be doing. You don't have like some weird animal in the Amazon that has no place. Some strange animal in the Arctic that has no idea what it's doing or what it's supposed to be eating or how it's supposed to be mating or how it's supposed to be. Everything seems to kind of know what it's doing on planet Earth. But it's not just that. It's the planet itself and the forces that act upon us. I'll give you just a few examples. First of all, the balance in our atmosphere is precisely suited to living things on this planet. Oxygen comprises 21% of our atmosphere. But if it were changed by mere percentage points in any direction, we would either spontaneously combust or we would suffocate. Of course, that's one point. If you've seen the movie Interstellar, you know that's part of the point of that movie. The gravitational pull of Jupiter, according to one whimsical interpretation, acts like a giant vacuum cleaner for our solar system. It attracts asteroids and comets that might otherwise pulverize our own planet. If our solar system's gravitational forces were altered by 1 in 10 to the 40th power, the sun would not exist. If the rotation of the Earth took any longer than 24 hours, temperature differences would be too great between night and day, and life would be unsustainable on this planet. If the rotation were any shorter than 24 hours, atmospheric wind velocities would be equally devastating to all life on planet Earth. And there are perhaps thousands of other seemingly incidental things that we could talk about from the creation. But one thing becomes undeniably clear. One or two of these conditions might be coincidence. A few of them put together might be coincidence. But when you have countless variables involved in the production and sustainability of life, that begs for an answer. And according to one mathematical calculation, the likelihood of life spontaneously generating on this planet is 1 in 10 to the 1,000th power. But that's not all. I see the answer to prayer. And again, the diehard atheist might scoff at this idea. He might laugh at the idea that answered prayers are evidence of God when so many prayers seem to go unanswered. Well, if there is a God, just pray that everybody in that cancer wing would get cured of their cancer, and I'd believe. All God has to do is just cure cancer. Not a big deal. I mean, we're pretty close to curing some of cancers anyway. Can't God just cure all of them in one fell swoop and we'd all believe in Him, wouldn't we? You know, the interesting thing is, oftentimes it's not that we get something when our prayers are answered that shows that God is working in our lives. It's that we learn something from God. Several passages that I want to point out. Go to Psalm 66. I've always liked this one. We'll read a couple verses here. In Psalm 66, verses 19 and 20. Look at the certainty that he has here. Certainly God has heard. He has given heed to the voice of my prayer. Blessed be God who has not turned away my prayer nor his loving kindness from me. Go back a page to 65, verse 2. O thou who dost hear prayer, to thee all men come. God is a God who hears our prayers, and we can be certain of that. I've always liked in James chapter 5, that in James chapter 5, beginning in verse 13, the writer of the book of James does not just consider it art or poetry or symbolism when it comes to prayer, but that prayer is real and prayer is practical and prayer is effective. He says in James chapter 5, beginning in verse 13, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing praises. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over them. He says in verse 15, that the prayer offered in faith will restore the one who is sick. The Lord will raise him up, and if he's committed sins, they will be forgiven him. Confess your sins to one another and pray for one another, because the prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. Now, we might not always see those prayers come to fruition in a literal, tangible way. But like I said earlier, it's not always what we get from a prayer, tangibly. It's not always having an illness cured, getting a job, finding a house. It's not always what we get from the prayer that shows the prayer has been answered. But it's what we learn from the prayer that shows that the prayer has been answered. Go back to James chapter 1. In that same book there, in James, and notice in James chapter 1, and we know in verse 2, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And then he goes on to say, of wisdom. If any of you lacks wisdom, and by the way, I don't think verses 2, 3, and 4 are disconnected from verse 5. They're not disconnected. They're not independent of each other. Verses 2, 3, and 4 are saying, the goal of your life is to learn. Because in experiencing pain and suffering, you become perfect. Will you ever get to the perfect and complete if you have not gone through the suffering? No. The perfect and the complete comes as a result of the suffering. So sometimes the suffering is the purpose of life. That's how you learn. That's how you grow. It's by the suffering. So I don't believe that the wisdom that you gain in the suffering is independent of the wisdom that you're praying for in verse 5. If anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given him. But you must ask in faith, without doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. Let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, because he is double-minded and unstable in all of his ways. You know why we go to God? We don't go to God because he's a vending machine. There's plenty of that in this world as it is. We don't go to God because he's a vending machine. We go to God because we want wisdom. We go to God because we want to know how to respond to the cancer. Now, the cancer might not miraculously go away. We can pray and pray and pray, and sometimes the answer physically is no. And that might simply be the reality of living in a fallen and broken world where people die, where people are hurt, where sickness and illness exists.
And in that case, we don't go to God for a miraculous intervention. We go to God for wisdom. God, you've said no. The thorn in the side is not going away. Help me deal with it now. Help me be strong.
2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. The Apostle Paul prayed and prayed and prayed that that thorn in the side would go away. And the only response that the Lord gave him was, "My grace is sufficient for you." In that sense, sometimes the answer to the prayer is no. And I don't believe that we lose faith in God because God says no to us. I believe our faith is bolstered because God gives us wisdom to endure it. I see the effect of rebellion in the world, and it's hard to ignore. I believe that God is real because God has already described what exactly will happen when people rebel against Him. And I see that played out all the time. Social evolution, like its cousin biological evolution, is the idea that the strong overcome the weak in a closed system. So, theoretically, you would think that planet Earth was only populated by strong, advantaged beings taking advantage of weak, disadvantaged beings. But that's not actually the case. Why do we have hospitals? Why do we have after-school programs? Why do we have homeless shelters? Why do people contribute to charities? Why do we give to the poor man on the side of the road when there is no evolutionary reason to do so? Shouldn't the weak die? Wouldn't it be better for the gene pool? Wouldn't it be better for the species? Wouldn't it be better for planet Earth if we could simply get rid of the freeloaders and the moochers? It's interesting that the theory of evolution, both social and biological, sounds really nice in a vacuum, but when you actually observe the world as it works, you don't see that played out. What you actually see is wicked people getting their comeuppance. I like in Proverbs 13, verse 15, the way of the treacherous is hard. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 8. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh shall from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit shall from the Spirit reap eternal life. Proverbs chapter 11, verses 25 and 6 says, the generous man will be prosperous, and he who waters himself will be watered. He goes on to say, he who diligently seeks good seeks favor, but he who searches after evil, it will come to him. We see all around us that sin and rebellion destroy people. Rich and strong, poor and weak, the average person, the ordinary person, and the very, very richest and elitist person. Which evolutionary process produced justice? I wonder. Which evolutionary process produced the idea of vindication? Vindication is not a naturalistic idea. What about the sense of thrill that we feel when the underdog wins? Why do we root for the underdog? Why do we root for the underdog? There's nothing about the underdog that should give us any reason to root for them. We should be going, rah, 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 we're all products of evolution as it is, so go strong. We should all be Yankees fans. Gotcha. Why do we root for the underdog? Why is it that when we watch a movie and the villain gets it at the end, why are we happy that the villain faced justice at the end of a movie? And why is it, oh, I hate those. Don't you hate the kind of movie where the villain gets away at the end? It's just so unsatisfying. Like, come on, lock him up. You know, blow up the Death Star. The villain can't get away with it. Where does that come from? This idea of justice. It certainly doesn't come from a naturalistic explanation. I see the effect of one sinner. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 18 says that one sinner destroys much good.
And when you observe human history, especially as the Bible presents it, you can see the way that Cain and Achan and Jehu and even David himself, the way that a little bit of sin changed the world around them, sometimes irreparably. Like a cascade reaction, everything we do is connected to the world around us. And I believe in the unseen because God predicted long ago that one sinner can destroy much good. But last but not least, I see the way the gospel changes people. And maybe more than anything else, the testimony of changed lives bolsters my faith in the unseen God. Nothing speaks to the movements of Him more than that. Even to the point that some believers are astonished by the changes that we observe. I remember in Galatians chapter 1, when Paul is recounting at least a portion of his own conversion story. He talks about how the way many Christians still had a hard time accepting that the one who once persecuted us is now one of us. I can look at people even in this own congregation. And I know some of your backstories pretty well. Because the thing that you don't realize about preachers is there's something about being a preacher where people are very comfortable telling you all their secrets. You get to know people pretty well. When you stop talking about how'd the game go, when you stop talking about the stock market, when you quit talking about how nice your tie is, when you start actually getting to know people and they start telling their stories, you realize there's some people with a dark past in this room. There's some people who had some pretty heavy baggage they were carrying until they met Jesus Christ. They met their Savior, and that baggage was gone. That dark past, nothing but the past. And it was a life that was made bright and new. And when I see the change that overcomes people because of their relationship with God through Jesus Christ, I believe in the unseen God. That's His handiwork. You, me, we are His handiwork. We're Him, the presence of God in this world, testifying, witnessing, teaching, preaching. That is the unseen God. Every Christian that you meet, every sin that is abolished, every life that is changed is evidence of Him acting in the world. As glorious as the scene is, I'm reminded of what Luke chapter 15 says. In Luke chapter 15 and verse 10, the way Jesus says how the angels in heaven are praising and singing and crying aloud when one sinner repents and returns to God. And that's kind of interesting because, you know, the angels don't live in the Grand Canyon state. This is a really pretty state. We go to the Grand Canyon and we go, whoa, there's nothing more impressive than this. We might see our favorite team win the championship. We go, well, that's it. It's all downhill from here. You know, we go to the Caribbean and we're like, wow, there's nothing cooler than the Caribbean. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff that we see on planet Earth. But you know what? The angels don't live here. And if they did, they'd be going, oh, wait, there was a baptism? They don't care about the Grand Canyon. They're not impressed by the Aurora Borealis. They don't care about the Super Bowl. But when one sinner repents, the angels in heaven are singing. That's pretty cool. The seen is glorious, but the unseen is better. Everything that we see here on planet Earth, it is passing, it is fleeting, it is failing. But Romans chapter 8, verse 24 says, in hope we've been saved. Saved from this broken world. Saved from a broken life. But hope that is seen is not actually hope. For why does one also hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance, we wait eagerly for it. We cannot hope for the things that we see. Silly analogy for you. If Romans chapter 8, verses 24 and 25 don't make sense, silly analogy. When I'm hungry, I hope for a sandwich. But if there's a sandwich sitting right in front of me on a plate on the table, I don't sit there and I go, I hope I can have a sandwich. You don't hope for that which you see right in front of you. You have the sandwich. It's right there. In the same way, our hope cannot be found in a job, and our hope cannot be found in a spouse, and our hope cannot be found in money or glory, and our hope cannot be found in the things of this world, as awesome as they can be sometimes. Our hope can't be found in that because we see it. It's there. It's already with us. If I want the Grand Canyon, I can have the Grand Canyon. And if I want that great sports moment, I can just become an Ohio State fan. I don't hope for that which I see. I hope for that which I don't see. It is so much better, so much more beautiful, so much more glorious. So yeah, maybe I can't show the unbeliever God's face. Maybe I can't show the unbeliever that God can be seen with our physical eyes. But my friends, that does not mean we don't have evidence of the unseen as the unseen acts upon this world. God is as real as the money in your bank account. He is as real as the person sitting next to you, as real as the job that we go to every day, as real as the home in which we live. And I would even say, beyond that, He's more real. This stuff is going to be gone someday. This stuff will be destroyed with intense heat. And when this world and all of its works are burned up, what will be left? Your soul and your Creator. And that's it. What will you choose this day? Mark 16, verse 16 says, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." And I encourage you at this time to come forward as we stand and sing.